This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest today has quite, I feel like I say this every week, my guest today is another super and incredible, powerful guest that I'm very excited to have on, as I say every week, but he is the grandson of the famed General George Patton that you've probably heard about from World War I and World War II. His father was also a decorated major general in the Army, and Ben went a different path, but he's still serving the community and serving American veterans through his nonprofit, the Patton Veterans Project. And there's clinical research that is showing that this is having huge impacts on veterans' lives. And it's also it's the first approach to treating veterans that I've seen in this format. So I'm very excited to dig into all of this. Before we do get into that, I do have a couple quick announcements. You guys have heard me talk about this a little bit by now, but like many of my guests, I do have a wild background myself, and I've seen that sharing it can save lives. So I do a lot of public speaking, and I also wrote a memoir about it. I don't have a release date for it yet. I expect it to be out in about a year. I'm currently going through a couple rounds of editing, but I've already written 3 drafts of the book. So to be kept abreast of updates with that and anything else that I have coming down the pipeline, the best place to do that outside of listening to the show is going to my website, zachtidwell.com. And you can also read a little bit about my background there if you're unfamiliar with it. Finally, this episode will be going on YouTube as video. I'm going to start tinkering with this and see how it goes. Obviously, doing this totally blind, it might be a crapshoot, but going to give it the old college try. So if you prefer watching your podcast, go check it out there. But with all of that out of the way, Ben, thank you for coming on, man.
It's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. But I would say that I wouldn't mind if you could give my wife that introduction, that I'm the most amazing and, you know, and whatever, all the things you said. But I appreciate it.
Yeah, caught me off guard. It's weird doing it live, and I caught myself rambling, but we made it through it, stumbled through it. So you can clip it and send it to her as a reminder and send it as a ringtone or something. I typically jump right into things on here, and I wanted to do that with you. I think chronologically, the thing that makes the most sense, I'm very curious. Chronologically, this makes the most sense, but also focusing on your life, right? And not harping on the accomplishments of your grandfather and your dad and the other men in your family who have really, I mean, your guys' lineage goes way back. And it's, I think a lot of people listening will already know that. But with you, I'm very curious, having grown up with a father like yours, what was it for you that, I guess on one hand, I'm curious, what made you choose a different path? Because I would imagine the family pressure there was probably pretty large to follow in their footsteps. I know, you know, most of the men in my family are veterans. And so that kind of directed my own path, not in any direct pressure, but I wanted to be like them. And so I admire the fact that you did take a different path, I think that was, you know, it takes big balls, especially with having men like that who've gone before you. And also, how did navigating that with your father go? Was that a contentious thing?
Well, let me just go back a little bit. First of all, I could avoid the entire answer if I just said, read my book, because I wrote a book about my dad called Growing Up Patton. And I cover a lot of that. And I sort of land on what I'm doing now. So, you know, one might charitably call my early years, professional years, fluid. I mean, I didn't figure out for a while what I wanted to do, but basically until I was about 17, I wanted to go in the Navy and be a pilot. And my dad was excited I wanted to go in the military. He never thought I should be in the Army either, because I was fascinated by aviation and I loved to sail. We sailed all over the East Coast and in the Caribbean as kids. And I knew a lot about military history. And so I was excited about it. The thing is, there's certain times, I don't know if you've ever had this, where your body just won't let you do something. You know, certainly that includes like jumping off a terrace, maybe, you know, when I'm afraid of heights, but I mean, but also it's like, you just can't physically do it. When I kept getting to the door of going in the military, despite how much sense it made my dad happy, all that, I just couldn't do it. So when I was a senior in high school, I just decided not to. Tough conversation with my dad. I'd gotten into the Naval Academy prep school. That's where they send people they don't want to reject, but need a little bit more maturing in academics. And that was a tough day, only because I think I'd built an expectation in my dad. But what I realized, although it took me to till I was maybe at least in my 30s and probably till I was 40, and I just turned 60 the other day, which is frightening.
You look great.
Oh my God. I've got some blind humor now. Oh my God. So anyway, I appreciate that. So I like to think so. But anyway, so what I realized in retrospect, and I'll talk about how I got into this world, is that I don't think my father ever really necessarily wanted me to go in the military. I think what he really wanted me to do was find my path. But he thought that I would have been good in the military for all those reasons I just said. And he also said, hey, you get in shape, you get disciplined, you learn how to study, and you come out with a job. And there were a lot of great reasons, which in retrospect, it wouldn't have been a bad idea for me to go in the Navy for 5 or 6 years. But when I've reflected on it, you know, whatever it is, 30, 40 years later, I realized that that in my family, it's not like another person applying to the Naval Academy. You know, when you go in my family, you got to go in like an NFL fullback. You know, you really can't say, well, I'll just give it a shot, because you can leave after 2 years from an academy if you don't like it. But
I didn't know that.
It just wasn't something I could do. And then I really struggled in my 20s. And then, you know, right after I graduated from college, Desert Storm happened. You know, I thought, oh boy. And my brother felt the same way. One of my older brothers, he just thought, gosh, did we make a fundamental mistake, or should we do something wrong? And it took me till pretty much, you know, till I certainly got into media at 30. And then I got into the work I'm doing now at about 45, or really at about 40. That I realized, you know, no, this is the path I should take.
And just through the fluid early career, and it was because you wound up becoming, you know, I know you've done all sorts of, you've gone down a bunch of different paths, but you didn't realize it until later on that you felt secure in this. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I spent my 20s, you know, doing enough different things. I started an environmental, kind of a slightly right of center environmental group that was sort of writing about private sector initiatives that were helping the environment. And that seemed to be a niche that, you know, needed to be filled. And then it got me into business school. But then I decided, and I think I was going to business school. I got into kind of a high powered business school overseas, and I only had a 3.0 average. So I guess they really liked my application. Didn't have any pull or anything. But when I got to the door of that, I realized that I was trying to build a resume for my dad, which was more about showing him that I had another direction I was going in. And it ended up not being that authentic. So I did something really crazy. I went and lived at a Catholic abbey for a year, where my sister is a Catholic nun. Now, I'm not Catholic. I'm Episcopalian, garden variety Episcopalian. And I spent a year there. I wrote about that in my book. I wrote a whole chapter about it. But I just kind of wanted to get out of the fray and do something that was just other. And I also wasn't as close to my older sister. She's 12 years older than I am and went away to boarding school and college and became something of a rebel and then just fell in love with this place. She was beautiful, you know, been proposed to several times by West Pointers and other people, but she just fell in love with this place like some people do. And it's extraordinary. So I spent a year there, you know, shoveling shit and pruning fruit trees and calving and slaughtering, you know, lambs or calves and things, whatever it was.
Just doing
and,
all the groundwork. All,
doing the whole thing. It was very interesting. This is an aside, but what I learned there is the cycles of the cycles of the world, which sort of for them parallel the cycles of Christ. You know, there's a kind of masculine and feminine in this place kind of working complement. You know, you plant the seeds, that's masculine. You let them grow, that's feminine. You prune them, that's masculine. The fruit comes out, you know, then you pick the fruit. You know, it's sort of a symbiotic relationship. And what was so fascinating, and I know I'm getting off on an aside, but we have a long time to chat, is they are able to look at everything they do, you know, which is basically taking care of a farm, and they also do Gregorian chant and produce several albums. And they can do that and sort of look at that in parallel to the cycle of Christ, you know, and I'm not speaking as a...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Christian, per se, I'm just speaking as someone who experienced this and went to Mass only so I could understand the rhythm of the place. But I really came out with that understanding, a more holistic understanding of vocation as much as anything. And they sort of have a mission that says to strive to be as good or better in their field as anyone. And there are PhDs and MDs there. And my sister was a horticulture specialist and all these things. And she speaks French, Spanish, and English, French, German, and English.
Wow.
So kind of amazing. Went to school in a German school. It's what's called the Gymnasium High School in Germany that was in German. So all these things. Then I came out and I sort of fell into a new career in music and eventually film, ironically or coincidentally, I should say, because a guy that was a very big supporter of the Abbey was a music producer who produced all kinds of jingles for Nickelodeon and all kinds of other networks. And he came up and said, I want to give a gift to the Abbey of recording a Gregorian chant album of women, because there have been some very successful albums of men, the Monks of Santo Domingo, perhaps before your time, but a huge bestseller. And so he produced several albums. And then I got out of the Abbey, and instead of going to apply to business school again, he said, well, I'll give you a job running my marketing and I'll teach you how to be a music producer. So that led me eventually into film and working in somewhat in documentary and mostly raising money and then eventually producing some shows for public television, nothing famous. Then
Can
the
I
next
pause
piece
you here?
Was... So, oh yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, this is great. I want to stop and dig into this a little bit more. You mentioned going on an aside. This is exactly what these episodes are supposed to be. They're supposed to be these meandering tangents and exploring this stuff. So I want to come back to, we'll put a pin in, you were working in public television and then what came after that. But with going to the Abbey, so... Obviously, there's the nuns there. There's a lot of highly educated people there. When you were there, and specifically because you mentioned the feminine and masculine kind of symbiotic nature there going on, are the other men there? Are they typically like clergy members that are doing the more masculine work, like you were in the stuff that you were doing?
It's an abbey of nuns. So the only male there that's a clergy is their chaplain, who usually is someone that maybe is the rector of another church, or he lives there in some cases, and he gives mass every morning and does vespers and so forth. But they have guests. It's kind of like a place where people can go to find themselves. Some go there to find a vocation and become a nun, or maybe a monk somewhere else. Some go there like as a gap year before medical school, or somebody who's thinking about converting to Catholicism. I went there as a way to step out of the fray and figure out who I was, you know. And I remember my older sister, I have two sisters, my middle sister, or the one above me, who's Helen, she had done that too. And she actually had converted to Catholicism and she didn't become a nun. But she had told me before I went, she said, you know, the thing about the Abbey is you're either going to embrace it or you're going to run away from it. You're either going to embrace yourself and facing yourself, looking in the mirror, or you're going to run away with it. And I embraced myself there. And I can make another slight aside about the Abbey, which is equally fascinating. And that is, why did my sister end up there? Well, she had been in college and she just had a roommate in her freshman year. I think she was at Bennington initially and then transferred to Dartmouth. And she said, oh, do you want to come visit this place this summer with me? And she said, yeah, it sounds interesting. She was looking for something to do. And she walked in and soon discovered that the lady abbess who had founded it, or co-founded it with a French nun, had been a nun in France in the 1930s. I don't think she wanted to be a Benedictine. She became a doctor. And she just, again, fell in love with the Benedictine faith order, and she moved over to an abbey outside of Paris. And lo and behold, 1940, it was invaded by the Germans, and so she basically went undercover. They didn't, you know, she spoke fluent French, but nobody could know she was an American. And then in 1944, August 27th, I think it was, the American troops, led by my grandfather's Third Army, rolled into Paris, liberated it, and she saw the white stars looking out of the cupola of the top tower of the church, saw the white stars unfold, the American flags. And she said, you know, this is a sign. I need to go back and sort of, I don't know, liberate the feminine or provide a service, you know, a foundational look place for people to come. And she and the French nun went over and they had like $10 in their pocket and they went to America. And, you know, somebody made a film about it in Hollywood, actually, years later.
You know what it's called?
It's called Come to the Stable.
Okay.
And the actress, we have to look it up. She was quite famous. I'll think of her name in a minute. Acted. It wasn't Grace Kelly, but it was somebody like that who acted. And it wasn't the world's greatest movie, but it parallels that story. And so it was just interesting that my sister wandered into this and then she fell in love. So, and the star was always a symbol of the Lady Abbess because of that. And so at one point, my father gave her a cross with like kind of a rosewood cross with one of his stars embedded in it. So that was pretty cool that she always wore.
That is so wild. That kind of made like my spine tingle a little bit when you were saying that. Like, and it was my grandfather coming through and liberating. Like,
I'll remember who the person was in a moment, but I will. Anyway, it was quite something. And so anyway, that was the story of the Abbey. And it really did help me to understand sort of how those rhythms worked, you know? So anyway, that's the story of the Abbey. And I became very much closer with my sister too, which was kind of a great thing.
So when you were there...
Oh, sorry, it was Loretta Young.
Okay.
She's quite a famous actress.
So you were there for a year. Was that your full-time gig?
It was my full-time gig.
Wow.
I was there ostensibly to look at a different type of school maybe to go to. You know, I got into this school, which is kind of amazing without any family connections. But as I got closer, it was a small school with, you know, 80 students, and it was in like Switzerland, and there was no help center, you know, and I wasn't with any of my networks. And I soon realized, I went there a couple months before I got a part-time job with the UN, and I started to realize, dude, I mean, this is not the right school for you. You know, you're dropped into the deep end. The school was a 2-year program crammed into 11 months. You know, this was hard. It was awesome. I could handle it now, but I never really learned how to study. I had a little ADD, you know, and I, in a way, it was kind of a cowardly way, shall we say, or you could call it courageous, but at the time it was kind of a cowardly way to make what turned out to be the right decision. And I remember a nun that I was very close with named Mother Placid, who was anything but placid. She's an Irish, feisty Irish nun that, again, could have done anything she wanted, but she fell in love with the place. And she was the one I got to know very, very well. And she said, what you were in was a crisis of process. And that turned out to be true.
Crisis.
It wasn't the right order of things. You know, I needed to find myself first, then come out of this crucible at this abbey, which is in northern Connecticut in Litchfield County, in a little town called Bethlehem, sort of strangely. So I came out of it more focused, and I thought, you know, actually, I've always liked music. I've always liked films. I was pretty good at what I did. I learned how to produce jingles for Nickelodeon and other, you know, things. And my boss had invented the nick, 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 do, 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 you know, that whole jingle. And then that led me into the world of film, because actually I sort of was self-taught, and I started doing sort of more like talk show productions that were fundraisers on PBS. But what was interesting is an old friend of mine whose father ended up in my book, my best friend as a kid, he called me and said, we're going to have an 80th birthday for my father. It was a black family. He was the first black 3-star and sort of a mentor to Colin Powell, sort of a generation before Colin Powell. Okay. And he said, we're going to make a video for the surprise 80th birthday for my dad. Could you produce it? And then I interviewed everyone in his family, and made about a half hour film, and it was great. It was great. And that led me into that business for a while, you know, and then eventually some other things happened, which I'll stop now, but I can tell you about, that led me to what I do now, which is help veterans find themselves through film.
Yeah. And I have one more question about the Abbey that I was going to ask you. So
yeah. What's the address? Do you want to go?
Yeah. You had mentioned that you got closer to your sister there. What kind of, is there any real separation there between the people who were there as the guests and the nuns? Obviously they have their duties, but I mean, were you able to actually, was it very limited contact with her while you were there? How did all that work?
I was controlled, but not limited. I mean, they have an enclosure. The Benedictines are a cloistered, largely cloistered order, excuse me, which means that whenever you're working on the farm, you're working with them, you know, and you're drinking Kool-Aid and you've got the chainsaws out and stuff like that. I did a lot of chainsawing and haying and things like that. So when I'm working my sister in the garden, cutting flowers or planting carrots, you're with them. But when you're in an idle place, they want you to understand, doesn't matter what religion you are, they want you to understand that there is a difference, that there's a difference between where you are and where they are. So they have these things called parlors. We'll go kind of to a little confession-like booth, except it's sort of a grid that you can reach your hands through and give them a kiss. It's really symbolic. Mm-hmm. And so we had some fascinating experiences around that, where I actually wrote a...
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
A couple little papers that sort of talk about living in complement, and her being the oldest and me the youngest, and a woman a man. And I actually made a set of andirons for a fireplace that represented the masculine and the feminine, with a fire coming up between them, which was drawn from a story that she told me about the patron saints and the founding and patron saints of the Benedictine order. And it's a whole other story I can tell you another day, but anyway, it was absolutely fascinating. We became very, very close, and I would say she's still one of my closest friends.
Wow, sounds like someone I would love to meet. Like, that's just obviously another very, very unique path, but it's just, that's such a foreign world.
Well, it's pretty easy to do. You can write them a letter. It's abbyvirginalaudis.com. And, you know, I can give you the tips on how to do it. You write them a letter and say, I'd love to come visit for a few days. And they write you back and, you know, they ask you why you want to come visit, and you give them a good answer and they say, come ahead. We'll put you to work.
Okay.
And believe me, whether you can see or not, they will find something constructive and helpful to their farm to do.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure they can, you just got to get me somewhere. I can do what you need me to do.
So, you got it. Oh, I'm sure you can.
All right. So back to, you know, you had made this surprise birthday film for this 3-star.
Yeah, I sort of transitioned into that. Then it led to other things. And this might be tooting my own horn, but if you Google my name in Smithsonian Magazine, you'll come up with a 2009 article that led to my book I think it's called Recovered Ground. There's also a video associated with it of clips of home movies of, you know, my dad, my grandfather. And it's really about how I got into the work of doing these biographies, because there was actually a precursor to that. In 1986, before I even graduated from college, I went to Georgetown. We had a fire in our house, in our ancestral home, and my dad had his office in the basement, and he left a cigarette butt in the garbage can, and it burned a hole through the house, and it, you know, destroyed all of his diaries. Didn't destroy the house, although they had to take every single item out of the house, clean it, and put it back. But he lost all of his diaries, and he used to keep these meticulous, well, not meticulous, but comprehensive scrapbooks and albums and things. And so a lot of that got lost. And so that led me to want to, you know, interview him, and it became the basis for a book that someone else did write about him called The Fighting Pattons, which wasn't bad. It just wasn't fully about my dad. And anyway, so that's kind of led me into this world of production. And then the next step, which is really relates to what I'm doing now, is that I'd always thought I would be a pretty good teacher and with kids. It was sort of what I would have done in another lifetime. And, you know, I'm good with kids. I sort of read them well and connect with them well, and I have a good sense of humor. And I was also getting into production, although I wasn't like a full-fledged editor, but I knew how to edit. And I was introduced to a guy who was kind of a blinking genius educator and filmmaker. And we decided to start a company called Fred's Experiential Media. And we just thought, if you're going to make films with anybody, why not have it be Fred? And so we came up with an idea for 2-week summer camps in Massachusetts and Colorado, where he lived. And we ended up having like 25 kids come for 2 weeks in sort of a day camp, and they'd make films. And what's relevant to what I ended up doing is that we started to see over the course of the 8 years we were doing it, that these kids were mostly making films about identity, about their adolescent identity, about their changing and evolving identity. You know, my first kiss, getting picked on, all those kinds of things. And so I had a conversation with my father's command chopper pilot from Vietnam, a guy named Charlie Watkins, who's one of the most wonderful people I've ever met, based in Colorado Springs. And he said, you know, this process might actually help veterans that are looking for their new norm. And so in 2011, I got an invitation, thanks to him, to go to Fort Carson, Colorado, where the 4th Infantry Division is based. And the division commander came, you know, was there, and the hospital commander gave me the sign off. And I'll never forget when General Anderson, who later became a board member, came to the classroom the first time we did it. And he said, okay, we're letting you do this once, but show me your shit. 5 o'clock, I want to see these films, you know, 1700 hours. So that led from one thing to another, and I can keep going, but you can break in and ask me more questions.
Yeah, I want to pause you again, because I want to come back. You had mentioned, so I read that Smithsonian article when I was researching you for this episode. I wanted to ask you some of, you know, I knew about the fire. I knew about your father losing his journals. And I also know that your grandfather was big on journaling.
It was journaling. My grandfather was more like writing, wrote a lot of letters. And, you know, our family was most famous for not throwing anything out. You know, I mean, we had the bloody shirt tape. We have the piece of shrapnel that went into my great great grandfather's stomach in Civil War. He was a Confederate, and the shirt tail through which it passed, you know, that killed him. So
you still have that?
Yeah, my one of my relatives has it. So it's pretty amazing. But my grandfather had 10,000 pages of letters and diaries when he died, which is one of the reasons, and not to get into this right now, but why some people say, oh, was he anti-Semitic? Was he anti-Arab and things like that? Well, when you've written that many things and gone through the crucible of war for, you know, decades, you know, you say things that maybe hopefully you didn't mean, but I mean, so he said a few things, but, you know, actions speak louder than words. He did an awful lot to help end the Holocaust. And that's always my sort of, not a defense, but kind of an explanation.
Also a very different time.
Yeah.
And yes, like you said, he's in the freaking pressure that man had to be under. Just, I don't think you can put yourself in that shoes. Obviously, anytime, especially like you said, there's so much stuff recorded in 10,000 pages of writing that, just like, you know, if I did, even now, in some of these podcast episodes, I've said stuff where I'm like, okay, that didn't come out very well. But you don't have a chance to take that back.
It doesn't excuse him. It just explains him. I always like to make that distinction. Yeah. I will say something that this is another tangent. This is a world of tangents today. But my brother and I gave a talk years ago, maybe like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that. Actually, it was, and it was to a Jewish audience, like a Jewish breakfast audience. And I think it was related to, actually longer than that, related to a book my brother had written about our family called The Pattons. It was quite some time ago. But he was asked that question. He basically gave the same answer. And this woman walked up at the end and very quickly noticed she had a number tattooed on her arm. She was a Holocaust survivor of Buchenwald, probably in her 70s. And she came up to him and said, I understand the criticism about your grandfather. They certainly make sense. He can't disavow what he wrote in some letter to some other guy. But she says the bottom line is in 1943 and mainly 1944, I guess you would say, in Europe, if Eisenhower and the Allied, Schaaf had let him do what he wanted to do, many, many more of my brethren would be saved. Would have been saved. And, I think that's true. If he kept hitting it and they didn't have Market Garden and a bridge too far and they didn't take away all his gasoline and they didn't slow him up a few times, he would have been in Berlin by Christmas. And there's just no way that's in dispute. And I read a book called The Prize about the history of oil by Daniel Yergin once. And he said that a famous historian, trying to remember his name, had said that, I think it was John Keegan, had said that fully a million casualties, Allied casualties, happened after September when he was stopped because of the Market Garden attack in the Netherlands. And had he, been able to keep going, that number would have been a lot lower. So that's the Patton defense of Patton.
Yeah. And that's also coming from a woman who obviously was through all of that and has, sounds like, done a lot of looking back on that and probably a lot of conflicted thoughts on it. And that's still where she arrived. Obviously not everyone's going to agree with that, but I think that carries a lot of weight.
Yeah, they did liberate, tens of thousands of troops of prisoners, not just Jews, but like in those concentration camps. In fact, he typically would make the city, the community folks, and particularly the mayor and the council members walk through the camps and help, bury the bodies and feed some of the former prisoners. And in fact, in one case, there's one called Ohrdorf, and you can even see a picture online of it. And the mayor and his wife went back and killed themselves that evening, And interestingly, we'll get into this later too, but the real military family, the side of my family that's really military is my mother's side. She has six generations from her brother, class of 1955, to the class of 1812. And her father had a combat command in the 11th Armored Division under my other grandfather. And he liberated Mauthausen, which was near Linz, without firing a shot, and also liberated a number of folks there. So, some actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to that too. But with your grandfather writing so much and your dad writing so much, obviously it sounds like in different capacities. Is that something that you've gone on to do, or are you like, I'm throwing this shit away when I don't need it anymore?
No, not at all. I don't throw anything away. My wife would like me to. I digitize a few things.
Okay.
I don't have any more business cards, and I put things on Google Drive and stuff like that. But I think it's interesting you should bring that up, because I think there's an evolution in the way we write. I think it is going to go downhill with AI and with email and texts. We're going to forget how to write, and certainly nobody's ever going to even know what cursive is a generation from now. But interestingly, when I came out with my book, which was came about as a result of that article, my brother's agent called me and said, "Hey, can you turn this into a book?" So I made a book that was sort of a series of chapters on different people that knew my father in every capacity I could think of: mentors, proteges, family members, friends, battle buddies. And so, and the son of Erwin Rommel, a chapter was about as well. That's a whole other story. But what was interesting about the letters is that, so you had my grandfather saving everything, writing all kinds of letters, and those did get saved, and they're all in the Library of Congress. I republished a number of them in my book. There's an entire two volumes called The Patton Papers, which has excerpts of all of them in there. But what happened is that over time, it shifts. My father and mother also corresponded during the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and they corresponded by reel-to-reel and then audio cassette. So it just shifted. And I have a number of those letters, in my book as well. So I think the nature of it changed. I actually had become a much better writer as a result of writing, or I should say co-writing my book and now working on another book on veterans. But so for me, I've tried to stay away from AI as much as possible until the very end when I want to get some last minute edits. But I do think writing will suffer, but I do think their just communication has morphed. You know, we still communicate creatively, and certainly the medium in which I find myself now of film and video is an incredibly fluid and robust way to communicate and to communicate emotion particularly.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing, because writing is it's unique because I feel like it can, well, that's not true. I was about to say it's unique because it can be taken so out of context, but that's
anything can.
Form of dialogue can be taken out of context. So that's not true. But I agree with you. I do think it's going to change. I've even, they've done studies already that have shown that people who are daily users of these large language models are showing decreased cognitive function, specifically like in the realm of critical thinking. I'm very wary of offloading things that don't need to be offloaded to AI. And I think that's something people need to just be cognizant of in general, whether it's writing or researching something or just anything. Again, like all of these skills that we have to build over time, like going to college or you writing your book and stuff like that, we accrue those over time, and it's very,
well, yeah. I do worry about it. My son is 16, and I was listening to a podcast recently by an author who wrote a book about the AI generation. He said that high school students read an average of 2 books a year for recreation now, and everybody, there's no way you're going to be able to control AI in every way. And I think it's inevitable that kids are going to be writing, papers using AI and stuff like that. And there are programs that say they can determine whether it's AI, but that's not really the case. And you have to sort of accept it and jump in the deep end with that and figuring out other ways to get them to be creative in terms of analysis or creative interpretations of things that maybe aren't replicable on AI. But I think it's a concern.
Yeah, I was listening to a gentleman. He was a psychiatrist who worked at the CIA and did a bunch of testing on stress and different means of inferring when people are lying and things like that. And it just, I think his name was Charles, I don't think Monroe's right. His last name started with an M. I can't remember it right now. I've been up since 1:30 this morning and I'm not thinking super clearly.
Well, you were preparing for this interview, obviously.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He also teaches now, and he was mentioning this. He was talking about specifically, these are his students or undergrad students. He tries to infer, and it sounds like he's able to do it pretty clearly with when these kids do submit papers. And obviously some of this reading in between the lines and catching when there are anomalies is you knowing your students, but also it's as simple as him sitting down with them and being, okay, like, how did you arrive at these conclusions? Or what did you mean when you said this? And like pull out something that is a very definitive like statement that they've made in this paper. And when they can't defend it or articulate what led to writing that, it's very clear that, okay, this is
that is it. They've got to do the work. And you can, and the teacher can say, look, I'm going to bust you on this if you don't do the work, And so anyway, but it's a concern, but I, working on it. Yes. So I can tell you, what would you like to cover next? You want to keep going with, why the Patent Veterans Project, why veterans, how it evolved, or what would you like to
cover? I've got one more question here, and then we can move along to it. You mentioned that your mom's side of the family, obviously also very long military history, but that families were over doing things in the same places in the same time. Is that how your mom and your dad actually met, was through relationships from your grandfathers on both sides?
I think it is. I believe they met at my mother's parents' wedding anniversary. I forget if it was 25 or 30. And I think it was, I just can't remember which one it was, but it was a significant anniversary. And, a lot of Army families that might be stationed in Washington, which is where they lived, would come. He got out of the military after World War II. So I think it might have been their 25th anniversary. And she, because she was about, you know, she was maybe 20 at Sweetbriar College, and met my dad. And I remember my dad was there with his sister also, who was his older sister, a wonderful sage named Ruth Ellen. And he went over to after he met my mom and said, "Damn, I think I'm going to marry that woman who took a swig of whiskey or something." And they fell. My mom hated him at first, but she thought he was the most ornery, you know, sort of self-centered person she'd ever met for a little while. And then she fell in love. But so they knew each other by reputation. But interestingly, my mother has some wonderful history herself. I mean, her, I guess, great-great-grandfather was a guy named Rene DeRussy, and he was a commandant of West Point in 1812, which is not long after it was founded. And then both of her grandfathers were chiefs of the U.S. Cavalry. Her great-grandfather won a Medal of Honor in the Civil War. It was Union. Maybe that's where the family fights come in. You know, my dad's side were Confederates, and there's some amazing, amazing things that happened. Like, for instance, I think one of my ancestors, maybe it was even that General Stanley that had won the Medal of Honor, I believe he had given a pass to his counterpart on my grandfather's side during the Civil War to go and see his wife when that part of Virginia was occupied by the Yankees, to see his baby born, or, you know, that kind of thing, you know, given a pass. Yeah. So it was just amazing intersections, but they fell in love. And my mother at one point just said, "Well, I'm in for a great ride." And there's a chapter on her in my book as well. I'm not trying to hawk my book, but it's a pretty good yarn, I would say.
Were you aware of did your parents make a point to make you aware and share all of this? I mean, that is incredible heritage in your family. Was that something that was kind of omnipresent in your childhood, or was it just, did you just think that was normal?
It was normal. I mean,
okay.
Well, again, it's not that, I mean, my family's more famous than any other people's families. A lot, most other people's families, I suppose, and in some cases infamous, but a lot of it is just that we don't throw things out. And my dad really, my grandfather and my father really drove into us the idea of remembering your history, particularly the bad history, you know, the history of things you're not so, you know, thrilled to remember. Maybe there's aspects of our Confederate heritage, or, you know, the Third Reich or whatever. My grandfather used to say, my dad told me, he says, "If you don't remember this history, you're destined to repeat it." This is something that, of course, you know, relates to Ukraine. My goodness. I mean, we should have known the Russians are going to do what they're doing just by reading about Catherine the Great and Peter the Great and, you know, the czars and, you know, and also like Napoleon's invasion of Russia, how that turned out. These guys just are willing to sacrifice bodies, you know, to win wars.
It's old school, that attrition warfare from World War II. It's trench warfare and attrition warfare. Yeah.
Yeah. And unless we get it together and, you know, allow them to hold their own by giving them all the Patriot missiles they want and some offensive capability, the Ukrainians have to lose because they don't have enough people, you know? And so that's true. Putin knows that. And Trump wakes up every once in a while and remembers it, and then the next day he forgets. But it's just unfortunate. But so history was critical, but we also got it from a different angle. My dad would come into, my brother wrote about this in his book, and he'd say, you know, Dad, he's 8 years older, Robert Patton. He wrote this wonderful book called The Pattons in about, I guess it was around 1992 or so. Really a beautiful yarn that goes way back to Scotland in 1746 and all that kind of thing. And in fact, it's mostly about how Patton became Patton and not necessarily all about my grandfather. In fact, we're making a movie based on that right now. So it was really important that we really understand this history. And my dad, like my brother used to say, he'd come back and he'd throw Polaroids on the kitchen table in the morning. "Well, this is what Charlie does to us." Boom, you know, and it's got like a blown up, you know, helicopter or something. And then he's like, "Well, this is what we do to Charlie." And he throws down another Polaroid of a blown up bunker, you know, of a Viet Cong bunker. And it was just kind of like, that's the way it was, you know. This is the warrior soul, you know, it's the way it is.
Yeah. It's just, I was, obviously I prep for these quite a bit and think about them a lot before coming into them. I was just thinking, I find it very interesting, regardless of the fact that it is that your family is famous, but the just knowing the history going that far back is so cool to me. Like, my family is very disjointed. I don't have grandparents on either side. On one side, you know, my both grandparents are dead, and it's been kind of a messy background there for a couple generations, and then there's just no contact on the other side of my family. And so it's like, I don't know really much about my family. Like, no one really does about the background. So it's just, that's such a cool gift to have, that there is that just breadcrumb trail going all the way back. It's so, it's just, that's so fascinating to me. Just the concept of it is so cool.
Well, I guess that people are still finding little nuggets, because they keep putting out books about my grandfather. I think there's been about four or five in the last 4 or 5 years. But, you know, interestingly, and you may remember from the Smithsonian article, but one of the first things I spoke about that I said in there, which was rather significant, was, you know, when we talked about the ashes on the fire of my father's diaries and all that, is that, you know, I had heard someone say to me once that when you lose a life, it's like burning down a library or ripping out a book of scripture. So you really, the first question I asked people, and I think if I didn't mention in that article, I've felt it for my whole since then. And that is, when somebody says, oh, I've got this dad, he's a veteran, he never likes to talk about, you know, anything that happened in the war, but then I know he has a trunk full of medals in the basement, blah, 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 blah. I would say, well, have you interviewed him? Have you gotten that on tape? You know, somehow on a dictaphone, on an iPhone, on a video camera. And a lot of times they say no. And then every once in a while, they'll say, well, we'll pay you to make a film about it. Or what they do sometimes, like in this one case of a guy that actually was in a POW camp with my uncle, who was married to General Patton's daughter, and he was a POW for 2 years, and a tough guy. He became a 4-star and commandant of West Point and all that stuff. And now I've lost my train of thought on that. Well, now I can't remember what I was saying. Oh no, don't put this in the podcast.
I don't edit these, so it's going to be in here, but it's fine. I forget what I'm talking about all the time. You were talking about the connection, because, you know, I had mentioned the family heritage, then you talked about the burning of the library, like losing a life, and how that's led to families mentioning to you, oh, you know, I have this grandfather with a trunk full of medals, but I don't have his story transcribed, and you started getting hired.
Right, and I met a family that were very close with us. And anyway, this guy had been, you know, I can leave his name out of it. Well, actually, it doesn't matter. His name's Hank Harmeling. And he was in the same Stalag that my grandfather, that my uncle was in, John K. Waters, who became the 4-star general. And I remember we used to go to a Christmas party in Massachusetts, down the street from us, where we had a home, every Christmas. And we go there. And then one Christmas, he took me down in the basement as I was starting to get into this field. He took me to the basement and said, you know, I'm going to show you my medals. And I said, wow, that's so cool. And he was about 80. And then I went to his family and said, look, his kids are well-to-do. And one son, he was a very successful real estate entrepreneur, said, you know, shoot, I can afford this myself. I'll give you $50,000 or whatever it costs. No problem. And we'll do it. And then they called me back a week later. And I was, sure, it's money, but it wasn't like big money for the amount of work it took, to be honest. And he called me a week later and said, you know, my dad doesn't want to do it. And I said, dude, the reason he doesn't want to do it is because it's you. And just like with my dad, it's like, oh, I've told you this before. You're not interested. But when somebody new comes in, particularly if their name's Patton, you know, they would be, they are interested. It's somebody new and different, and they can share it with them. And especially, so I never got to make that one. And I was so bummed. I mean, how cool would that be to hear the story of what it was like to be, you know, imprisoned with General Patton's, you know, son-in-law for a couple of years. I mean, geez. So that was one of those ones that got away, but several others didn't.
Yeah. And that's, and I will hold by, I want to ask you about specific, as a writer, I want to ask you about co-writing. I'm curious about that, but I'll come back to that at the end, later on. I want to start getting into this, right? Like, so this, you started getting hired for these, you missed that guy. And that's, I'm glad you actually brought that up with him not wanting to get into it with his son. Cause that was another thing I was curious about, was as you started getting into this, were you finding that because it was someone, I guess on one hand, first of all, it sounds like that guy's son might've been a little rough around the edges, maybe because of ego, but like it, in cases where that's or in situations where that's not the case, I guess on one hand, like are a lot of families uncomfortable to broach?
Oh, sure.
Things
are they uncomfortable talking about it? Yes, you know that, like you know your name. Of course, this is true of a lot of vets. And so, you know, we used to work with any vet. Initially, it was with vets at warrior transition units that were either transitioning out of the military with some medical issue or going back to deployment, you know, going to be redeployed once they got their stuff sorted out. And so it was a different population than we're doing now. Now we focus on, we no longer do it at VAs or military bases. We do it at colleges and community colleges, but in, you know, places where there's a high concentration of veterans. And typically, at least now, after having done it all over the country and in Israel, now we're at the moment, for budgetary reasons to some extent, but also because I want to sort of build out from a strong center, we're doing it in high suicide areas, mainly in the Rocky Mountains. We're going to go to Oregon and we're going to go to Alaska pretty soon. But right now we're working in, you know, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado. We're going to go to Utah and Idaho. But, you know, Montana and Wyoming are basically one and two in suicide, you know, prevalence. And I think you've talked about this with my very good friend and mentor, Dr. Chuck Drubbing. But and I know I listened to the podcast and he gave you some examples of some of the phenomenon that's just phenomena that's really hard to grasp. But basically they go up there so they don't have to talk to people like me or you about what they've done. And they don't realize that puts them on track to depression, anxiety, loneliness, and suicide. And so, you know, that gets to the spirit of what we do, which is, you know, we bring veterans together over a weekend, surround them with professional filmmakers. And I've got some very, very good filmmakers. One of them won an Oscar. Chris Unko won an Oscar for being the DP on a short animated film produced by, you know, Sean Lennon, based on a song of his father's, and very talented folks. And, you know, and they're willing to come make movies with General Patton's grandson, you know, and what we found is that tends to draw them into a place sort of mentally and emotionally and psychologically where they're willing to get help. Not that we won't have, you're welcome to come, whether you have PTSD or not, you're welcome to fly out to Colorado and come to one of our workshops. We have one this weekend in Montana. But I think it's just not about the money. It's really about helping these vets unpack themselves, you know? And again, even if you didn't have, even if you never deployed and weren't, you know, didn't have an assault in garrison and really had nothing happen bad to you, you know where the veterans are that are struggling better than I do. So that's kind of how we focus on recruiting.
Do you have, and I had a farmer, Dev Gru Seal, on here, Monty Heath, a couple months ago, and he ended up doing a lot of work after he got out of the SEALs as a volunteer, specifically in the realm of helping people through military sexual trauma. I can't remember if that's specifically the nonprofit he was working for was specifically aimed at that, or if that happened to be a very prevalent thing there. Mm-hmm. But the statistics around military sexual trauma that he threw out kind of shocked me. Is that pretty common in terms of coming across your guys' projects as well and coming up with veterans that you guys have coming through?
I mean, pretty common. I'm not so sure. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips about MST. I had them around suicide, but not so much MST. But I will say that, you know, generally there's obviously much more incidence of it in women and there's much less reporting of it proportionally, by men, but it's occurred. I've had three or four that I know their names and I keep in touch with them that are men that have been assaulted, often in garrison, either on a ship or during one that I'm very good friends with that I've gotten to know in the last several weeks, during basic training, you know, and this person, here's the amazing thing about this case. This guy was basically raped or thereabouts. He didn't give me the details, but in basic training. And then he was a whistleblower. He did an anonymous note, you know, with a lot of details so they couldn't refute it. And that guy was let go, you know, was kicked out of the Army, dishonorable discharge, like 3 days later. And a week later, that guy committed suicide. Not my friend, but the guy who was the perpetrator.
Wow.
And so I've had guys, a big, strong guy I worked with in New York one time, and he looked like, you know, from The Blind Side and, you know, Michael Orr, but he had been also assaulted. And, it's a tough thing. And now the women are, you expect it more. In fact, you almost assume it sometimes, But I have some extraordinary films. I haven't had a film relating to the male MST, but I have had a bunch made by women recounting in creative ways what happened to them. There's one in particular that's just absolutely extraordinary. It's on our website at patentvets.org, and it's called Scenes of Service. It's on the feature films page. It's about 4 minutes long. It's sort of a montage of images and scenes with very little talking. And it's extraordinary. And it sort of is about transcendence as well. But that was made by four women, actually five women, who had never met before. And 2 days later, they've cranked out this beautiful, beautiful film. We've decided to enter in a few film festivals.
So it's 2 days.
Yeah. The whole workshop is about 2.5 days. And the first night they come in, they learn a little bit about the science and the art and the creativity around filmmaking. They make a little short silent film. You know, it's kind of an exercise where they have to depict a word like persistence, frustration, love, grief, you know, agony in a sort of 5 or 6 shot silent film, just to depict it. It doesn't have to be about the military. But that teaches them about the intentionality of film. In other words, if you don't have the right shot in the right way, somebody might interpret it as greed versus envy. You know what I mean? If you have a guy, if your scene is about some guy stealing pizzas, you know, he grabs one slice and then he looks at 7 boxes because it's a classroom of people eating pizza and he takes them all. Well, that's greed. But if the last shot is on some other guy that's watching him take the pizzas, that's envy, you know? So, you know, it's really about that guy. So it teaches them about the intentionality of film. And then we say, look, so if you didn't get the exercise right, it doesn't matter. But tomorrow you're going to start making a film about something you care about. And that's when you want to make sure you lead the audience in the right direction. And so basically we'll have some exercises. We'll break down some scenes from cool films like Witness or Forrest Gump, or lately we've been doing Parasite and Office Space, you know, all these kind of things. Yeah. And you'll break it down, you know, color and music and all these things. And then we'll create a big circle of everybody, no back rows. The instructors will be there too, because at that point, we're kind of like just a bunch of people making films together. Even the clinician will slip in there. We always have a clinician on hand, and they'll often slip in there. And then we'll just throw stuff up on the wall. What do you want to make a film about? Transition, you know, my wife, family, you know, divorce, suicide, watching my film friend get blown up in front of me, why I hate the Army, why I love the Air Force, all that stuff. Then the magic and skill of my instructors is to distill that down over a couple of hours into 4 or 5 ideas. Then they match up with an instructor and they just self-select into groups, maybe change groups here and there. And then they conceive the film in a couple of hours. Then the next day they go out and shoot it. They edit it that night. Maybe there are a few tweaks after the workshop. And then a month later, we come back and we show it in a community venue, because that relates to the book I'm going to write, which is about that relationship between fellowship and post-traumatic stress and trauma and community. As you look back over all the American conflicts, you know, how those arcs of technology and communication and family involvement all sort of evolved.
And that community is so important, not just from the, yes, we are social creatures, but suicide is a problem of despair, right?
Like, and that loneliness.
It is the despair and not seeing a path out of the place that you're in. You're in so much pain and so lonely, like you're saying, that you aren't in a clear-minded place and not rationally thinking about your circumstances and just literally blinded to the fact that there is a way forward. And a lot of times in my opinion, in all cases, that is reaching out in some capacity. It is that community. It's also, you know, it could be seeking help from a professional or just someone that you trust. But I think the other side of that is that community is also a net, in the sense of, I think these warning signs that are touted are kind of bullshit and they miss the boat for a lot of people. I think they capture part of the population who is heading towards suicide. I think it misses about half of it though.
I would say that, and sort of, to sort of lend embellishment to that, I would say that, you know, nobody blows their brains out when they're hanging out with their friends, making movies, going to church or to picnic. You know what I mean? It happens in the middle of the night and your wife's out to the movies, or in the back of a trailer park or a national park or something like that, you know?
That's not sometimes, true. So let me finish my thought
here. I mean, at
least
my experiences of ones I've met have. Is that not true, do you think?
So this is, I think there's something to that, but that this is where I was going with the other half of that, and that not encapsulating everybody. Like, I had the opportunity all the way up until minutes before I shot myself in the face to tell someone that I was in that spot. I had decided 4 days beforehand I was going to shoot myself. The day before, my parents were at my house with my sisters in the very same room where I had just decided I was going to shoot myself. And my roommate came home early from work while I was recording a suicide video to my family. I paused the video, went out and talked to him like nothing was wrong, and then went back in my room and shot myself.
Mm.
And I chose to hide that until the last minute. Mm-hmm. And it's that other component that I think is where the community comes in from the safety net. Like you're saying, like, yes, no one... Now, I had isolated myself away from people. Like, I'm solely responsible for the place that I got, and that's not what I'm saying. But then in the sense of, if there is a community there and someone hasn't fully isolated, or if they already have the community and they start to do those things, it's people who know them very intimately that will notice those small baseline changes that aren't overt. You know, I wasn't making Facebook posts. I wasn't giving my shit away. I wasn't doing these typical behaviors and making comments about all the world would be better off without me. I was killing it at work. I was going to school full time too and getting straight A's. And like, that is not an uncommon thread either. And so that's where I think the other beautiful side of the community aspect that you're connecting with these guys with and guys and gals with is, if they do start to make connections with these people and they start to lean into that community, those people will then notice those small changes where they do start to withdraw, or they're noticing that they're being agitated around things that they're not normally, or, hey, this is an anniversary day coming up for this guy where he lost his entire fire team. And this is, you know, we know he typically struggles around this. And I think that's where these interventions happen, where someone can come in and say, Ben, I'm worried about you. I've noticed you've started drinking a lot more. You're not reaching out like you typically do, and you've been really short with me lately. I'm worried about you. Are you planning on killing yourself?
Well, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me, but I still say, again, and I only speak from an indirect witness to suicide. My son, my older son Tiger, his mother, long after we were divorced, admittedly, lived right across the park. I can see her building, and she took her own life about 6 years ago. So in that sense, I mean, I can relate to it in a small way, but I still will say that you still self-isolate in some fashion, and the community, you know, it can be around you maybe, but it's engaging with the community. And them engaging with you. It's about you listening. It's about them listening. It's about you talking and them listening to some extent. But I mean, it really is, takes some level, you know, of initiative ultimately to turn it around. And like, for instance, you know, in a small way, if some veteran or you had a friend that was really screwed up, or you wanted to come and be like, you'd have to decide, I'm going to do it, or I'm going to tell my friend to do it, or I'm going to beat the hell out of him or something, do this workshop, this film workshop. But you know, it takes that sort of encouragement, but ultimately that at some point, this doesn't go just for veterans, but somebody with those kind of feelings that's depressed or anxious or has suicidal ideation has to take a step themselves.
Yes.
You can't hold their hand forever. Or if you do, they're on, you know, the psych ward forever, you know? But I just kind of believe that. I'm not right about all these things. Oh, I do have a background in developmental psych, but I'm not a practicing psychologist, So, you know, and I wanted to understand, I've studied a bit more since then. I want to understand what happened with my son and his mom and so forth. But anyway, there are a lot of theories on it, but I can tell you this, collaboration is the only way to make a film. You know, I always give an example saying you can't make a film by yourself, except for Grizzly Man. He made films by himself. Remember what happened to him? You know, the guy got eaten by a bear.
Didn't come out too great.
Eaten by a bear. Along with his girlfriend. It was horrible. But I mean, I used to get laughs when I was at the Army bases. It doesn't get laughs nowadays when I'm at a community college, you know. They're like, oh my goodness. But did he really say that? But I come from an equal opportunity to offensive family, so I get away with it once in a while. Yeah. So anyway, so that's my feeling about that. I think we're making an absolute impact on that. We're tracking at least the big thing that I know Dr. Drebbing talked about was this notion of enrolled and unenrolled vets, particularly as it relates to suicide. So they about a third of the vets that came back, I call a vet anybody who's ever put on the uniform, active duty or not. A third of the men and women who served that came back from the OIF and OEF had some level of post-traumatic stress, they say. Many of them didn't have a chance to be diagnosed, but two-thirds of those are not enrolled in mental health support. And so, you do the math on that, it comes up to about 400,000, and about 60,000 of those are in the Rocky Mountain states. So there's a bunch of them, you know, and the suicide rate up in that area is like 2.5 times the norm in some of those states. So I know we're making an impact, and there is a difference, because we did a clinical study, which you may have read about, with the VA. It wasn't a huge sample size, but it showed that of veterans that were sort of in the category of having post-traumatic stress. I mean, you call it disorder. The diagnosis is PTSD, but I usually skip the D. But that had some level of diagnosable post-traumatic stress and were not enrolled, largely people that were in transition out of the military, but were not enrolled in healthcare or mental health support, took an appointment with the VA or someone else within a couple months of doing our workshop, which is pretty awesome. And we're creeping up to those numbers now, because remember, now we're just taking any veteran, but they're going out and finding the right veteran. So I know we're making an impact. And just recently, it was in a newsletter that we put out a few days ago, a guy that actually had lunch with last week, he had done one of our workshops, came to the community screening about a month later. And he's struggling. He's in a wheelchair. He's got Parkinson's. He's got a couple kinds of cancer. He's been homeless. He's had, you know, he's come close to taking his own life. You know, he had an MST. He was given the microphone to come out and present his film, you know, and they're all excited because they realize very quickly they know more about their film than anyone else. So they don't have to be nervous about it. Like, yeah, I made the goddamn film, get over it. But, yeah. And so somebody in the back of the audience, there were like 50, 60 people there, said, hey, how did you change as a result of this? Obviously you liked the workshop, but how did you change? And this guy, I love him to death. He goes, I no longer want to commit suicide. So that's very different from saying, hey, we help people, to saying this guy told a room full of people that we saved his life.
It gave him the perspective to see, like, all right.
And it's true. And I'll give you another little quote. You know, I'm famous for quotes in my family. Of course, half of them that my grandfather is thought to have said, probably you didn't even say. But they still work. They sound very Patton-esque. But I worked closely for several years with the head of mental health at the Bronx VA named Rachel Yehuda, Dr. Rachel Yehuda, mental health chief there. And she at one point said, you know, she observed these workshops and these veterans. And she said, you know, what this workshop does is it helps a veteran, you know, see things in a different way, you know, especially themselves and their family and their future. And once you can get a veteran to kind of, to look at things differently than they have, then anything is possible.
It sounds so corny, but like perspective is everything. And not what you said is so corny. I was qualifying what I was about to say. It was going to sound corny, but like it sounds cheesy to say that, but it totally is. The way, and it's opening the door for that to have it presented in that other light. I mean, it is, obviously, I was about to say it can change the trajectory of someone's life, but obviously it has. And that's just one example. You guys have served, I know when we first connected, it was over 1,500 vets at this point. I mean,
that's about how many we've got now. It's 110 workshops, you know, 300 films. You know, interestingly, last week I gave a presentation to it's a big acronym called NASDVA, National Association of State Directors of Veterans Administration. So all the government appointed commissioners for veterans, and they were all in Wyoming. And I showed a film, and I also showed it to the Deputy Secretary of the VA, who I connected with on LinkedIn. By the way, I encourage anybody to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm making all kinds of posts in the last several months just to sort of gain more visibility and, you know, viability and, you know, conversion to support. And so look me up and connect me. I put out one out on 9/11 about my experience at 9/11. But anyway, I showed a film that's up on our site. It's at patentvets.org, and it's in the film, feature films page also. And it's called Maybe This Time. And I don't want to spoil it, but I will. It's just a 3-minute film made in a day in Bozeman, Montana, by three vets and an instructor. Instructor happened to be a civilian. And it's about a guy who comes in for the fourth appointment of the week. And he's like, the guy, this clinician's kind of, civilian clinician's kind of phoning it in, saying, well, are you feeling thoughts of suicide? Are you feeling thoughts of depression? What's your anxiety? And the guy's like, dude, you've asked me this question every day this week. I think it's time you saw the world through my eyes. Takes his glasses off, gives them to the clinician. And the guy sort of sees all the combat before his eyes and all the difficult things in the bodies and so forth. And the best part of it, I'm just going to spoil it because it's still beautiful. The best part of it is then he says, I get it. He said, I've got somebody that can help you. Here's his card, you know, and the guy walks out and says, great, man, I'll see you next week. So then he calls the next patient. A woman comes in with her service dog, very nervous, breathing heavily, and sits down. And then she looks at the guy sort of waiting to start the conversation. And he says, can I borrow your glasses? It's pretty awesome.
That was made at one of your guys' events.
It was shot in like an office and a reception room. I mean, this with a budget of zero.
Are the actors the veterans?
Yeah. I mean, if they want to pull it, Chuck Drebbing, but Dr. Drebbing's been in about 10 or 15 films.
Really?
You know? Like, hey, Chuck, get over here. When he's at a workshop, unless he's dealing with an activation, which is why we have him there, or another clinician, you know, he's no longer Dr. Drebbing, you know, he's Chuck. Hey, Chuck, we need an extra. Hold this light, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. So the instructor happened to be the clinician. He was the right look and nobody else was available. Then you had a couple of vets, a man and a woman that were in it, and another guy behind the camera. You know, we empower the vets as much as we can. And also, I can get into this a little bit because it's significant.
Yeah.
They control pretty much every aspect of the production. And like you go in there and I say, look, you can make any film you want as long as you can finish it by 6 o'clock on Sunday. So they can't go to, you know, Las Vegas and shoot a film at the slots, you know, because they can't get there in time. But they do have control over what they do. We're essentially the banks of the river. We know a lot about making films and I've helped make, you know, several hundred. And I didn't go to film school. I'm the only guy in my team that didn't go to film school, but I watch a lot of films and, you know, you don't have to be a filmmaker to be able to, or a vet to know whether you like Patton or not. You know what I mean? And, you know, we're all film critics. That's why this medium is so incredible. Cause we all understand it. Probably our kids better than anyone else. But anyway, so they, you know, it's a very safe thing. You can choose, you know, Zach, am I going to be behind the camera, in front of the camera? Am I going to be an actor? Do I want to write it? Do I want to bring up the fact that I tried to kill myself? Or do I want to sort of not share that in the group? It's up to you. And you even get to decide whether you're going to allow us to show it on YouTube or at a screening at the end of it. The only thing I always say is, like, before we get deep into it, I say, look, when you guys establish your group, make sure you've talked to the rest of your group to make sure some guy just doesn't go, no, I'm not showing it, you know, on Sunday afternoon, which happened once. And I had to talk him into signing a release because we don't ask for a release to share the film until after you've finished it and seen it in the classroom.
And which seems
of the
fair.
1,600 vets we worked with, every single one has signed it. Every single one.
Wow.
Which is pretty kind of amazing. I doubt that half of them would have signed it if it had been before. You know, because when you're in 60 Minutes and you get, you know, Trump or Obama to cry on TV, you want to make sure you have the release, you know, already.
It's so interesting. And when, you know, when Chuck connected us, I was like, this is just, it is fascinating. And I mentioned that during my rambling introduction for you, but it is, and Chuck is an angel. Like I admire that man. And I'm so glad we were able to connect too, but this is, have you guys done any audio description for any of these things?
Audio description? What do you mean by that?
So there's audio description is an accessibility thing for blind people where instead of like closed captions, like you might do for deaf people to be able to read what like the dialogue or what's going on. You had a narrator in breaks during dialogue.
We haven't done it per se. I'd be happy to do it. You can just strip out the dialogue. But I would say that would only work for about 25% of our films because that silent film exercise I described shows these veterans, participating veterans, just how powerful the video is at showing emotion through visuals. You know,
that's
I
the
mean,
point.
Think of films that you like and how many of them rely on a whole lot of narrative. You know what I mean? A whole lot of talking. I can think of two examples right off the bat. One is Lincoln, which kind of breaks the rules. It was a great film, but that was a lot of mostly talking. The other one, which I say in a critical way, was the last Mission Impossible film, which wasn't quite as good as the second to last one, I don't think, but the last one, Dead Reckoning or Final Reckoning, I think it was. The first 15 minutes was like a summation of somebody explaining, you know, explaining what had happened and how this thing got to the guy's going to blow up the world and AI and all this stuff. It took like 15 minutes, and it is not the thing that film is best at. So the problem with your suggestion is that I'd have to pick through, I'd probably come up with, you know, 50 films or something that where the dialogue is going to tell you what the film's about, like two guys sitting at a table and having a chat. There are some like that, but most of them, and frankly, the more powerful ones are the ones that don't have much speaking in them.
Well, that's where audio description describes what is there visually. I know that's like a
big undertaking. I'm happy to explore it. It hasn't been my top priority, but if there's a way I can do it economically, I absolutely would do it. Why not? I have a brother that was special needs and couldn't read or write, and he had other disabilities, but I mean, for sure, you know?
Yeah. And I was just curious. I wasn't like putting pressure on. I just didn't know.
No,
if
no
you
pressure.
That, but
I don't respond to pressure so much. So coming from my family. So if we wanted to explore it, we can do that offline. Be happy to. Cool. And I could come up with some ones that, of course, it's easier if you can hear the sound and it makes sense, and the ambient sound and the soundtrack, you know, to give you context. I mean, you don't necessarily want to have to hear every word, but that is something like a book does. But to do it at the pace of a film to give you enough context through reading can be very tough if it's a fast moving thing.
Yeah. And that's why I was just curious. I didn't know if that was
on
your radar or not. But,
let's do it.
Yeah. And that's, I know what I wanted to come back with or back to just in my curiosity as a writer as well with your book and co-authoring it. What was that dynamic and why did you co-author it?
Well, that's the secret. Remember, I got the 3-0 at Georgetown. So let's go back to that for a moment. And being a little ADD, I don't know if I had the H, although my mother-in-law, who's a Navy nurse, said that I should stop drinking coffee 2 years ago, you know, caffeine, because I had too much energy. I don't know if that's the same thing as hyperactivity. But anyway, well, the reason is I'd always been interested, particularly after my father passed. I was just sort of intrigued by idea of working with veterans. That's what gave me the idea. You know, I forget what year it was, around 2000, where I started doing these narratives about families, the one from the Smithsonian. And then she said, you know, you should write about that. You've made 6 or 7 or 10 of these films. You should write about that. So she said, let's write an article. I'll help you write. She was the best writer in my class, as far as I could. I remember reading a couple of her papers just for fun, and they were like on Kandinsky or something, and they were fascinating. Couldn't take my eyes off them. And so she said, well, look, let me help you write an article for something, and then we'll figure out where to put it. So we did 19 drafts, came up with that article.
Jeez.
And then I had another friend that said, I would say is mostly her writing, because I didn't know what I was doing, but it sounded like me. That was what was so great about her. And then we went to another friend of mine who was an editor at the Washington Post, and I said, would you put this in the Washington Post magazine? He said, it's too good for that, but I've got a friend at Smithsonian. So we sent it to Smithsonian. The guys brought it back with like hardly any changes. And then I got a call from my brother's agent, said, can you turn this into a book? And I called up Jennifer Scrooby, who's a lovely writer. And I just said, will you do this? And we got, you know, moderate advance, which, you know, he got a piece of that. And we never got much more after that. But we wrote it together, and it was just incredible. So I recommend a writing partner, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
So I got that from the Abbey, right? I mean, the Abbey lives in compliment. They live in compliment with Christ. They always have, you know, teams of 2 or 3 people that are usually, it's a triad that develop projects like building a new church or something, and it really is about working in complement. And so I found that to be incredibly helpful. I mean, you could say it's true of marriage too.
Well, yeah, it would be helpful, especially even as a sounding board. Is that like, as you guys were writing it, is it, hey, I write a chunk, you write a chunk, and we're passing it back and forth as...
Well, that's how it started.
Okay.
I read a chapter, you read a chapter. Then pretty soon, in fact, I'm making an audiobook, you know, 12 years later or 13 years later right now, about halfway finished with it. It'll be on Amazon, hopefully by Christmas. just because a lot of veterans have asked me, and again, people don't read quite as much, but people are in their car an awful lot sometimes, especially up there, right, in Montana. So, so I started reading the chapters. I called it the other day, and there was a chapter on the Abbey, and it required you to read the Lady Abbess's biography. And, you know, I skimmed it, but I was like, this is like good writing. I don't remember writing this little part. And so there was a point at which she did a bit more research than I did with some of this, because a lot of it came out of my head. But it was interesting because at one point she said, I like the way you speak better than the way you write. So why don't I interview you for some of these things? She was in Florida, but we did a lot of interviews. I mean, I did interviews of my mom and my sister and a bunch of generals and other people, and that black general and his son and all these people. And, but in the end, you know, she also interviewed me, and it made it hold together much better because it sounds like me. And now I'm writing the book on my own, but I have asked her to edit it. So we'll see. But,
that's cool, man. And we've come full circle with everything.
We've come full circle.
A neat way to put a bow on an episode. You mentioned people reaching out to you. I will have all of your stuff linked in the show notes and all that good stuff. But do you want to tell them again where they can find you?
Yeah, I would say in terms of just a general understanding of our what we do, going to the website, looking at some of these films, you think about, you know, handful of vets and an instructor made this in a day and a half. You know what I mean? Basically, that's kind of impressive. The workshops are free. There's not a lot of them. There's a couple a month in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, but you can sign up for them on the website. You know, you could fly yourself there. You know, and occasionally I've provided a ticket to somebody on rare occasions, but you know, and if somebody's coming from out of town, I'll put them up in the hotel room, but they got to get themselves to Colorado Springs or Denver or Bozeman or wherever it is. And you can also subscribe to a little newsletter we put out, which I think is cool. It's designed largely to stay in touch with the vets after they've done workshops. And I named it, you'll never know the source of this name, but I call it the Nickel. I just started it a few weeks ago. And we're going to put it out every 2 weeks, and it's 5 minutes of inspiration. And the name, I think you'll enjoy this, comes from the code word my grandfather used for the relief of Bastogne. You know, there's a famous scene in the movie, October 19th or so, or is it 16th, I guess, somewhere in there. No, not in October, December. And they're in Verdun, which is the site of the most gruesome battle, like in World War I, you know, 900,000 casualties. But anyway, they're meeting, and Eisenhower's there, and Bradley and the British, and they're like, we've, you know, Battle of the Bulge just started. The 101st Airborne and some other divisions are surrounded in this Belgian town of Bastogne. How can we relieve him? Patton, meanwhile, is cruising across Europe. He's on his way to Germany. And he says, I can engage. And he waits till everybody else answers, at least in the movie. So, you know, they say, oh, I can't do it. We're busy here. We're busy there. He says, I can engage two divisions in you know, 48 hours. And Eisenhower's like, dude, come on, give me a break. And he says, no, I can. He said, and then he just, when they say, okay, go for it, he just says a code word Nickel over the phone. And then because I told them which routes they were taking, because, you know, as a soldier, one would know that you can't just like, it's not like overland, you know what I mean? You got to go on the roads and the highways, and these tanks weigh, you know, several tons. So anyway, that's called the Nickel. That would be the love for people to sign up for that. That's largely for the veterans. We always take support, $25, you know, $50. I don't care. You know, we're going for bigger game in terms of fundraising through LinkedIn, but anybody who wants to connect with me on LinkedIn, just Benjamin Patton. I've been putting out a post every 2 or 3 days and about all kinds of things, you know, Patton family lore, leadership, the work we're doing. And, you know, times I spent with my dad going to mess halls at Fort Hood, Texas, you know, at 6 in the morning, stuff like that. So those are the ways. PattonVets.org is where it all starts, but I think LinkedIn would be a good one as well.
Sweet. And you're doing it without AI. So go read it.
You got it.
Thanks, man. You gotta let me know if you guys are rolling through Denver. I'm in that area. So
we are rolling through Denver. You want to come and do a film workshop? We're doing one in October in Colorado Springs.
Well, yeah, we'll connect offline and see if I'm going to be around, and that'd be cool to see how all this works. And yeah, I would.
Well,
I would
no pressure, it. Zach, no pressure, but a little bit. But I will say that if you're helping us tout the workshop and stuff, they, you know, that saying, the best salesman uses their product.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to do it. So thank you, man. Thank you. I know you said you'd never gone for an hour and a half. I don't know. Did we hit it?
We hit it, baby.
There we go. So
Thanks for taking the time, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks to your listeners. And they can, by the way, they can write me anytime they want at ben@patentveteransproject.org. I'd love to connect with them. Or LinkedIn. That's an easy way to connect me as well.
Sweet. Thanks, everyone at home.
All the best.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone at home, for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, please take a second to rate and review the show wherever you're listening. If you're on YouTube now watching the show, subscribe to the channel, and then share this thing around with someone who needs to hear it.